The White Network presents The Heretics Hour with Carolyn Yeager.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to The Heretics Hour on this April 14th, 2014. That makes it, as written in numbers, to be 41414. And these numbers, 41414, added up individually, add up to 14 also. See, now when I noticed this last night, I thought that was pretty special. You know, to have a day that's 4-14-14, and then to have these numbers add up to 14. And so I wrote yesterday that I wrote down for myself that I expected some constructive things will have been accomplished today, along with some major or minor changes. Well, that was my prediction, and it has so far, of course, the day's about over here for me, and so far it's been kind of like that. I would say it's been like that quite a bit. Pretty interesting, but I'm not going to go into that. I just will tell you that I'll be taking your phone calls in the second hour, and that Guillermo Rudolph will be calling in shortly. So before he does, I want to set the stage for our subject a little bit. About 10 days ago, Charles Kraft and I mentioned in an interview, just moving my mic back now, just released with David Cole, an interview with David Cole, the Jewish Holocaust revisionist who disappeared in 1998 because of alleged attacks from the Jewish Defense League. I'm saying alleged because I don't have any proof of that, but I'm not saying I don't believe it. I do. And whoever else. And anyway, now he has written a book about his adventures as David Stein, the new identity he took, and is doing interviews to publicize his book. In this interview with Ryan Dawson, Cole said that while there were no gas chambers at the big camps, he believes there were some small number of gassings in smaller camps, and one he is sure that took place was at Natzweiler-Struthof camp in Alsace-Lorraine in 1943. Now, you know, Alsace-Lorraine is that area between hi, Guillermo. I was just saying the area between Germany and France, which sometimes belongs to Germany and sometimes to France. I was describing Alsace-Lorraine. So here's Guillermo Rudolph, and how are you tonight?
Stressed out, but that's its normal condition at that time of the day.
Oh, well, if you always are, it's been a bit of a stressful day. I was talking about the numbers. It's a 41414 today, and that adds up to 14. So we have some numerology going on here. So it's kind of a special numbers for today. And I think it's a day of constructive things, but also changes, which can be unsettling. But anyway, I'm glad you're here. I've been looking forward to doing this topic for a while now, well, 10 days or so. And I finally got it going, and I'm so happy that you agreed to come on tonight to help me do it.
Yes, thank you for having me, and I appreciate being able to talk about these things that interest me too.
Yes, that's just wonderful. So that's exactly what we're going to do. I was just kind of setting the stage for how this came to my attention when David Cole, I listened to an interview, and I think you're familiar with that interview between David Cole
yes.
and Ryan Dawson. And I was just saying what David was saying about this limited small number of gassings in some camps, but not in the big camps. And see, now this was news to me, and I didn't want to believe it, and I decided to look into it, and I found that it's not really news. I mean, that it's been a part of Holocaust historiography all along that there was this particular gassing of under 100 Jews at Natzweiler-Struthof, and But most people aren't familiar with it, and if I had ever read about it, I forgot about it. And I had asked you about it, and you sent me some information. And you have even more of that tonight. So I don't know if you would be okay if I just go ahead and finish what David Cole had said on that interview, and then you can hit into it. Well, he went on to say that that this was arranged. This took place because of a certain Dr. Hirt, H-I-R-T, a professor at Strasbourg University, that I had just mentioned that place, and that his wife and children had been killed in an air raid. He didn't say where or whatever, but that made him he's very upset about that, and he wanted to get revenge. And David Cole portrayed this Dr. Hirt as Professor Hirt as a kind of nutcase, you know, weirdo, whack job. And he was intimating that there was, he was saying there was a number of those Nazis that were these whack job nutcases. In a way, I guess, saying that they weren't all that way, which is good, but that some of them were, and that they on their own did things, which is really not the way it was, but they sometimes, you know, were tortured people and were cruel and sadistic and did all kinds of stuff. To help give a bad reputation to the National Socialists. But anyway, then he said that this Dr. Hirt decided to assemble a collection of Jewish skulls for a permanent exhibition, and he wanted the skulls intact without bullet holes. So he requested 100 living Bolshevist Jew Russians, or he just said Bolshevist Jews, which would have to be Russians, or it wouldn't have to be, but I guess they wouldn't have to be, but 100 living Bolshevist Jews to be shipped to Natzweiler from Auschwitz. And he was saying that this shows that there was no gassing facilities at Auschwitz, or they would have gassed them there. So he thought that was a good thing, and I think that maybe other revisions might think it's good for that reason too. But therefore, they had to be shipped alive to Natzweiler, and his request was granted, and 98 Jews arrived. And then they had prepared a building already for, with air, that was airtight with proper ventilation installed that for, to use as a gas chamber. And he didn't know what kind of gas was used, but he assured us several times, the listeners, that there was a full unassailable paper trail of the whole process. So it was irrefutable. It did happen. It's proven, and that these 98 Jews were gassed in 3 separate batches, and the corpses were taken over to the university or delivered to the university and put in cold storage. And then he didn't know what happened. He said some of them were found after the war, still under refrigeration. But I think the story kind of ended there. So some of my points that I question here is that there are stories about skulls and there are stories about skeletons in all this information. So which was it, or was it both? And then the number selected and killed varies. And this Joseph Kramer story, he didn't bring that up at all. And no doubt, because he doesn't believe it, as we don't believe it, but that Joseph Joseph Kramer did confess to doing the gassing of 80 of these 86 Jews, turns out to be 86, personally, because he was commandant of Natzweiler at the time. And then but to me the most important thing is the commissars, that it started out to be, they were going to use captured Jewish commissars from the war, which means that they would have been executed anyway. So that's why they use people like that for these things. And then the timing of it kind of varies around a bit. So what's your comment there, Garamar, if anything?
I remember back in the early 90s when David Cole had just gotten into revisionism. He was touring Europe with some other revisionists. They were touring several camps. In one of the camps, they stopped by and did some quote-unquote research. was Natzweiler. And Cole, at that time, already made comments to a similar effect to what he's saying now. So it's not very new, his opinion is nothing that's just come up recently. It's something that has been around for a long time. And actually, I think Robert Forreston was part of that group of revisionists that went over there, and they had a falling out just about that time when they were in this camp for a number of reasons, disagreement over what was going on there being only one point. Forreston has made statements, various statements about the Natzweiler camp since the early 1980s. And I think he was the one who in 1982 discovered a report of a pharmacologist from Paris who, right at the end of, or toward the end of the war, when Alsace was liberated or occupied or reoccupied or whatever by French troops, went in there and they found the bodies or some bodies that were allegedly killed in some context, and he made forensic research on them trying to determine how they were killed, and they couldn't find a cause, that is to say they couldn't find hydrogen cyanide or anything like that in any of them or in any of those.
Now, are these the ones from Natzweiler, the bodies?
Yes, that's right.
Well, that's another thing I forgot. I'm glad you mentioned that right away, that nowhere does it say that there's any forensic studies done on these bodies. Yeah. After they
these
were found.
Are actually the only bodies, the only corpses that were ever found in or around German camps that were subjected to a systematic forensic analysis as to the cause of death. If I'm not mistaken, Bergen-Belsen had some corona coming in, do some research there too, basically saying they all died of typhus, malnutrition, dysentery, and anything similar things, but no murder. And the ones in Alsace, they were particularly looking for hydrogen cyanide poisoning because of the Zyklon B myth has been going on for a number of years, and it couldn't be verified. Now that's pretty much the end of the story when it comes to hard proof, which wherever they died and whoever they were and why they were sent to Natzweiler, they were not killed in the way that mainstream historiography claims. And coming back to the Kramer testimony, Kramer was a former camp commandant of the Natzweiler camp for some period of time during the war. And he was interrogated about that and made a number of statements, three or four of them, inconsistent, self-contradictory, and nonsensical in many regards. And therefore, knowing how the conditions were, he had to suffer in British custody like Rudolf Hess, like others. He most certainly was abused, tortured. You can basically not give them any credence whatsoever. So that's where that story ends. Now, as to the paper trail that David Cole has mentioned, the unassailable paper trail, there is a paper trail requesting Hirt and Bickenbach or some other professor requesting Jews from Auschwitz, and then Auschwitz agreeing and them being sent over, and they show up then in the death registry of Natzweiler on just one or two days or something like that.
Yeah.
Very close together, all together, which indicates they were indeed, were entered on the same day, which makes it suspicious that they were actually killed on the same day. That's all we know. We don't know how. We don't know essentially what for, that they were supposed to serve as a starting point for a skeleton exhibition, a skeleton research or whatever. A lot of it is conjecture, but there are some documents that indicate some.
You know, I have some of these. Well, I just took them from the internet, but you know, some of them are on here, and maybe I'll read the one that's most interesting to me is again from this commissar story, and it's the earliest one. It's from February 1942. Now, these people. Let's say that the way they've got the story, the way the Holocaust historians have got the story, it was, they say that Heinrich Himmler sanctioned this project, and maybe it was suggested by Professor Hurt, and Himmler said okay, and he appointed two men, his secretary Rudolf Brandt. I don't know if that would be right or not, but that's what they say. Himmler's secretary Rudolf Brandt and Wolfram Sievers, who was general manager of the Annenerbe, for being responsible for procuring and preparing the corpses and getting them to Professor Hurt, and then he was going to make this, you know, skeleton or skull collection. And so then in 19, they have something, a report, supposedly, from, written by Sievers, the general manager of the Annenerbe Society, not Institute, from February 1942, and this was read at Nuremberg by General Telford Taylor, who was the chief counsel, at the Nuremberg doctor's trial. This was read out, and he says, and Sievers wrote, we have a nearly complete collection of skulls. Now here he's talking about skulls, you see, not skeletons. Skulls of all races and people at our disposal. Only very few specimens of skulls of the Jewish race, however, are available, with the result that it is impossible to arrive at precise conclusions from examining them. The war in the East now presents us with the opportunity to overcome this deficiency by procuring the skulls of the Jewish Bolshevik commissars, who represent the prototype of the repulsive but characteristic Untermensch. We have the chance now to obtain a palpable scientific document or, you know, exhibit. And he said, the best practical method for obtaining and collecting this skull material could be handled by directing the Wehrmacht to turn over alive all captured Jewish Bolshevik commissars to the field police. They in turn are to be given special directives to inform a certain office at regular intervals of the number and place of detention of these captured Jews and to give them special close attention and care until a special delegate arrives. This special delegate, who will be in charge of securing the material, has the job of taking a series of previously established photographs, anthropological measurements, and in addition has to determine as far as possible the background, date of birth, and other personal data of the prisoner. Following the subsequently induced death of the Jew, whose head should not be damaged, the delegate will separate the head from the body and will forward it to its proper point of destination in a hermetically sealed tin can, especially produced for this purpose and filled with a conserving fluid. Then, having arrived at the laboratory, the comparison tests, anatomical research on the skull, as well as determination of the race membership of pathological features of the skull, blah, blah, can proceed. And they need to take photographs, measurements, and other data, and finally the tests of the skull itself. So now, you know, what you know about these things, Germar, do you think that would be have to be absolutely correct? Do you think that report is what the man really wrote, or do you think they could substitute something else or change it a bit or whatever? Although, I'd accept it.
Well, it's not impossible. I mean, you've read it now in English. It's, of course, a translation. I'm not an expert in mm-hmm. these things, so I must say, maybe not. I know that all belligerent parties in that war did medical experiments and did this and that. Anthropology was in early stages in that time. Genetics had not been developed yet. So the news, things are being inherited. They didn't know how to measure it, how to determine which way traits are being inherited from one generation to the other. And they were trying to get their hands on it by measuring bones, skulls, whatever. Now, of course, 10-20 years later, DNA was discovered. And since then, we know where the information is stored. That wasn't the case back then. and being racialists, the National Socialists were eager to do something about it to determine what makes people tick apart from environmental influences. And they had several radical approaches, and during the war, things like that were possible, and some people may have pursued it. Yeah, it's possible.
Well, right.
But,
and, you know,
but it's also, it is also possible that things did get skewed, that there are mistranslations, that there are misrepresentations, complete forgeries. All this has to be taken into consideration if one does critical research on it. And as far as I know, Robert Forrestal has scratched the surface by looking for these forensic reports. And what we have done since is basically only reciting what mainstream historiography has done about it. I don't think anyone really did some in-depth research. I can remember remotely that some French revisionists, not so I don't know, being French territory, has done some publications, was Plantin Renoir, one of those younger French revisionists has done something. I couldn't put my hands on it right now, I can't find it. But it was available only in French, and it has so far not been translated, so I don't know what the depth and the value of it all is. Things that have yet to be investigated more thoroughly. Now, I sent to you a text about the whole issue a couple of days ago or a week ago when we started talking about that. That is a chapter from a new book that will be coming out at some point this year by Carlo Martogno, reacting to a mainstream book.
Let's go to that in a second. Let me just put my little two cents in here that I do know from previous research that during the war, when the Germans did I guess under the auspices of the military, like some of this was, they did medical experiments. They used people they had in custody who were already condemned to death. They were condemned to death, and then they said, okay, we want to have you participate in this experiment, and it could be fatal if it's, you know, but you're going to die anyway. And but if it's not fatal and you survive, then we'll give you a reprieve of some kind, you know. So the people would say, okay, what else were they going to say? But they weren't just, but what's happening here is that this makes sense to me that they'd say, well, we got these Bolshevik commissars they had this plan by this time to execute them whenever they got hold of one. So we'll just, they said, set these aside and send them over and we'll do it this way. So this was the original idea. And then these stories, and most of these stories on Wikipedia, don't have any sources. They're just written like a story, you know, there's no footnotes or anything. They just go on and on. And they make out like, well, they just went there and, got ordinary prisoners of all different types and so on and then killed them. Brought him over there to be killed. If any of that did go on, they would have been using prisoners that were already condemned to death.
That's presumably. Yeah. Which brings up another issue. Should they have been condemned to death, you know?
Some of them, you know, some of them were condemned to death for cause. I don't know what all the causes were, but I mean, some. You know, there were executions and so on.
Yeah.
So, but anyway, you know, that's never mentioned when they talk about any of these medical experiments or so on. So, okay.
All right. Yeah, coming back to Martogno, he has written, well, the German edition was published a couple of years ago, and the English edition, even 3 years ago, the English got stuck because he then had qualms about it and he wanted to do revisions, and it's still being revised to death. Anyway, at some point it will appear. I have reread this thing now that the preliminary version, that's not going to change much because I've seen the changes that's supposed to be implemented in the book. That kind of stays. And it shows that Martogno, who may be called one of the most knowledgeable revisionists, he doesn't really have a lot of material, original documentary material at hand either. A lot of the stuff he repeats by quoting mainstream sources. Usually, Matonya is very particular about not relying on mainstream sources quoting their books and articles, but go to the original documents and make sure they are kosher. But in that chapter, I've checked it, and a lot of the stuff that's being stated there, he repeats and assumes a lot of it, okay, for the time being, because he doesn't have access to the documents, he assumes, for the sake of the argument, that they are correct, which they may not. And in a series of arguments, he says, well, that doesn't sound good, that doesn't make sense, so something isn't right here. For instance, he also rejects completely the Kramer testimonies because they make no sense. They are contradictory, right, and so forth.
Kramer said he mixed some salts with water and made a gas.
Yeah.
It doesn't say what kind or anything.
The commandant of the camp himself goes down to a little chamber to kill a few Jews, and he's developing the gas, holding his nose over it while pouring it in there. Probably killing himself in the process. He has no clue what the material is, so he has no idea whether or not he's going to get killed himself. This whole story is outrageous. And the primitive procedure that's said to have been used is so laughable. I'm amazed how much Orthodox historians can swallow without turning red, blue, or whatever color. It's just absolutely amazing. So the whole story makes no sense as it has been reported by Kramer. We don't know how they were killed. Cole says, well, probably Foskine. The fact is that they had, from other documents, they had some gas chamber at Natzweiler before the Jews arrived, and there was work done on it. We don't know whether it was a disinfestation gas chamber or whether it was a training gas chamber. There's talk about a training gas chamber for SS or Wehrmacht personnel to handle gas masks.
If there weren't any gas chambers, really, why would they? Then this whole training gas chamber story would be wrong, right?
Yeah. As I said, my knowledge of it is limited, and even the Colonel Matonio's knowledge is somewhat limited.
Yeah.
So
now,
really,
one thing about Matonio is that, and you know, of course, I respect him hugely, and he's, you know, I know all the great work he's done and so on. And, he and say like Thomas Cuse, some of these, revisionists, they want to get at the main big lies, you know, they want to get at the gas chambers and the plan and the this and the that. If some little bit of stuff goes on that they doesn't bother them that much. I mean, they're not trying to defend the Germans or the National Socialists from every bad thing that was could have been done. So they'll let some of these things go, particularly if it helps to show that their big thing that they're working on could not have happened. Like Cole brought up that since they had to send those Jews from Auschwitz over live, showed that they didn't have any gas chambers at Auschwitz, any way to gas them at Auschwitz, or they would have done that. See, so he thinks that's, you know, he's doing something good there, I guess. And I think Matonio and some of the others do too, and Cuse tends to do that, do too. They'll go along with some things. It also makes them look more reasonable, you know, not
yep.
like they're saying no, no, no to everything.
The Orthodox story is that the Germans had gas chamber in all the euthanasia institutions, which there were five in Germany all in all, and even in some Western camps. Dachau is supposed to have had some, Ravensbrück and this and there, and then you have the huge alleged extermination or mixed forced labor and extermination camp in the East, which are all supposed to have been equipped with some kind of execution gas chamber. Now, if they really had a need for executing people without destroying a skull, that was allegedly a daily procedure by the hundreds of thousands in all of these camps. So why ship them across the whole of Germany from the extreme east to the extreme west, as German borders were then during the war? Makes no sense at all, indeed. And if you look into what procedure they are supposed to have done, what Kramer says, bungling about in a ridiculous way, not knowing what they were doing. Excuse me, for years they're supposed to have been the masters in execution technology of butchering hundreds of thousands of people in chemical slaughterhouses. Why then bungle about? Nobody has an idea what to do. Kramer says he had to get advice from Professor Hurt personally how to do it. Give me a break here. The SS has been executing allegedly over 1 million people by that time with various kinds of poisonous gases, and we're expert at it. Are we? That's what we are told. And obviously the whole Nazi story refutes that. If any of it is true, it shows that nobody in the SS, nobody in the entire realm of German power at that time had any idea on how to do that properly. So they shipped them alive over there so that they would somehow execute them. That's the point that Cole has been making. That's what Martinio says too. And to say, okay, maybe it's true. Let's assume for the sake of argument it's true. It just proves that all the rest cannot be true. So we grant you 80 killed people in a gas chamber, which prove that 6 million were not killed in gas chambers. Yeah. All right, that's the balance we can live with as revisionists, and that's the easy way out. Now, the proper way out would be, of course, to get down to the nitty-gritty of documentary archive of research and really try to find out what did really go on in Nutzweiler. It may have been poison gas, it may have not been, you know, you can execute people by just putting a needle into them. There's no need to go through complicated procedures of
that's
stuff
so
that
true. Guys that, build this little gas chamber and set it all up and put people in there and batches and so
risk getting killed yourself and
it's so ghoulish and that's why they like it though because it's more ghoulish and it makes the keeps that image up.
That's right.
Well. But this skull and collection and or skeleton collection doesn't sound overly outlandish to me. I can imagine them wanting to do something like that.
Yeah, well, they found a specimen in the Strasbourg medical department after the war. Not just some corpses that were still stored there, but a number of things that they had collected. Now, in what context they were collected is a different issue, and that's then exaggerated and distorted too. But again, I'm not an expert at that, so we can't discuss it in detail.
Well, you know, like Cole said, if they, well, he didn't say this, but implied it, if they were gassing people regularly at in Auschwitz, and even if they didn't, well, I guess it doesn't matter. They could have picked out the ones they wanted and then put them into a group, or they could have picked them out afterwards or something. But if they had all these people being gassed all the time, they certainly wouldn't have any trouble finding some good specimens there, you know. So it is strange that they can say they can tell this story the way they do, and then not think that it, you know, not think that people will think it all the way through, and say, well, that doesn't make sense, you know. I mean, if they were doing all this at Auschwitz or other camps, why not just get the ones that are that they were already gassing?
Well, for most people, they don't have all the facts at hand, and they don't think rationally. It's not a topic to think rationally about for most people anyway. It's an emotional topic. And you see, well, the Nazis were evil. They killed 6 million, and they killed another 80 on top of it to get some skeletons, whereas the other skeletons were burned. That makes it even more evil that the two stories don't mesh. That doesn't cross anyone's mind who has the critical mind turned off. And as soon as the topic comes up, most people have their minds turned off. It's the lower areas of the brain that are functioning then only on the basis of emotions and reflexes. That's exactly what these stories are geared toward, to make you stop thinking critically.
Yes. Well, and then Graf, in what he wrote about Matonio's book, because he translated it, and he wrote a little bit of a foreword. He doesn't sound like he's convinced about it at all. But
That's right.
He says that Matonio has gone along with it, but he didn't provide any clear documentary evidence.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's more work to be done, and we shouldn't all, you know, Matonio may have written something that we disagree with, but, you know, we should do a better job. I mean, he has done tremendous work in a lot of areas that none of us have right to complain that in this particular area didn't do the same kind of work at the same level and standard. Do it better. If you want to complain, do a better job. That's all I can say about it. Whoever feels like this is interesting and important and should be investigated properly, go right ahead.
Right. Well, see, that's it. You know, I depend on people like Matonio and you and so on for everything I know, because I don't read I don't have the languages, and I can't read all these documents, and I don't have the energy or ability to go search, you know, go to original sources and go to sites and find these things. So, so of course I'm most appreciative, but I just, I don't like accepting anything, because the whole revisionist, basic revisionist position is that there was no gassing. Mm-hmm. And so then if we say, well, there might have been a little bit of gassing here or there, it kind of destroys the whole position.
Yeah. Well, the truth is never black and white, and if it turns out that the white picture has a few gray spots, so be it.
Yeah, but like you said, there's other ways to do it, and it's kind of hard to think that they would resort to doing it that way when they could kill people other ways so much, you know.
Yeah. Even if you use some other poison gases as they were used during the First World War, people knew them and could kill with them. That's always very tricky, no matter what gas you deploy. Gas is volatile by definition and diffuses in all sorts of directions. It's dangerous. So if you can help it, you don't use things like that. Carbon monoxide is still the best way to go about, because even if it gets out, it dilutes quickly, and then it's not dangerous anymore. And it doesn't adhere to anything. It doesn't accumulate anywhere. So what they say about the euthanasia killings, they were done with carbon monoxide. It at least makes sense, technically speaking. It's not the most toxic substance, not at all, but at least it's very easy to handle, and it doesn't jeopardize the executioners themselves. Whereas if you start apply anything that was used during the First World War, even stronger chemicals that the Germans had at their disposal, the first nerve gases, you can't really use them without jeopardizing yourself. So you better think twice and come up with a proper technical solution to do that. And who would try to construct a new device which takes time to develop and then build, and for just getting rid of 80 people, it makes no sense.
Mm-hmm.
So I doubt that.
Well, and then they say that the people who are pushing it and the people who discovered certain things or brought things to your attention or whatever is the Simon Wiesenthal Center and the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum. So, you know, the usual suspects get involved in that and put their own stamp on it, probably. Now, Now, what do you think about the skeletons? I mean, sometimes they're talking about skulls. You think that they could have started out with the idea of skulls, and then they would have headless skeletons? They're not going to have a headless skeleton. So, if you're killing people for their skulls and you still have the skeleton left, you know, why would they have those two different stories?
I don't know. And it's all speculation for me right now. So who knows?
Yeah. And then they
have bigger fish to fry.
Well, and then they have, 100 and, well, of course, David Cole, he was just guessing, though, at 98. But then in this 1943 Seavers, I don't know, story about him, they said it was 112 that were selected and killed, prisoners. And this was for the skeleton collection. And then later it was 87, but there's only 86 were gassed. So that those numbers don't match up. And then they were doing this in 1944, and then they decided the Allies were, you know, they had to cover their tracks. And there is some telegram or something. Yeah, a telegram by one person to another saying that, well, we've got all these, but they're all these things here, but they're not defleshed yet, and we can either destroy the, do something to them, but then we're going to lose our whole collection. But they had to do something because the time was getting short and the Allies were moving in. So I just don't know if those you know, if a telegram like that is correct, or if they just put it in there, you know, if it's fraudulent, because it doesn't say anything very clearly. And when they got there, I'm still not clear, Garamar, on what they found. They didn't find much. I guess they think that they had been buried. They think they buried what they had left there. And they have a picture. There's a picture of a woman's body who I guess had been preserved. It looked very good. Dead, of course.
Well,
dead.
Photos of dead people toward the end of the war were cheap in Europe, because there were millions of them, and you can put any caption on any picture claiming anything. And the documentation of when was a picture taken by whom, where, and what exactly is depicted, and how do you prove that what you claim about it is true, that's a difficult story. I remember that on one of those pictures you can see a number written on one of the limbs of those corpses, and it's claimed that's an Auschwitz registration number. Martinu mentions that, yeah, this registration number existed, it belonged to that and that prisoner. The problem is that the number on that limb is so big, so wishy-washy, that it's probably not a tattooed number, as they were common in Auschwitz during that time, but it's something that was put on there with a marker to make it look like.
Well, yeah, because they have this on the Wikipedia, on one of the Wikipedia pages, they have this gruesome looking picture of a corpse inside of some kind of container, but from the waist up and the arms and so on, you can see he's out, pulled out, and they're wrapping him in some gauzy material. And there's a number on his arm, and it's huge.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's not like any number would have been.
No, that's not the way they were.
Right.
Whereas on Elie Wiesel, you could see it easily, which you can't.
this is very mysterious and hard to see.
Yeah. Anyway, so some of it is fishy. Wouldn't be surprised if somebody ever managed to get the whole story together with all the documents available, that it can be shown that things have been distorted and that a story was different after all. But which way, I don't know.
Well, there you go. So I think what we've established anyway, I'm happy that David Cole saying that this is irrefutable, this actually happened, there's this fantastic paper trail, is really not the case. And it is refutable, and I, you know, does this mean that it didn't happen or it did happen, but probably not like at all like they said. So we don't have to go along with that. We can keep arguing about this. You know, keep questioning this particular one along with all the others.
Not with the knowledge we have right now. And more critical research has to be done before we should touch the topic again, because yeah, from here on, most of what we do is speculating. And
well, and as you say, there's bigger fish to fry, so nobody's putting too much attention. But Matonio did write about this some. Well, when is this book going to be coming out? And is it how much of this book, this new book by Matonio, is about this Natzweiler? Or is it the whole thing about it? Or
No.
What is it?
Okay, the whole book as it stands has 16 chapters, 15 15 of which are focused on different camps, and it's a response to a mainstream book that came out in 2010, if I'm not mistaken. Any of the listeners may remember that as a reaction to early successes of revisionism, mainly Robert Forreston's Challenge and then the Arthur Butt's book and some other stuff, led to some upheaval in the Orthodox community, and they made a conference at the Sorbonne in Paris in the early 1980s, basically an aftershock of the Forreston provocation in the mainstream media. And a little later, the Germans had a similar conference in Stuttgart, and then they published a book, Nazi Mass Murder. It came out in English 10 years later, I think in the early 90s. And some 20 years after the, or 25 years after the German book had been published, they had another conference in Germany just now in 2009, 2010 or something, talking about progress that mainstream historiography had done on the Holocaust, and in particular on refuting revisionists. And so the book actually states, we are here, we know now better, and we can refute revisionism even better. Mm. And then there are a number of articles written by a number of authors addressing various camps and all their alleged extermination methods. There is Auschwitz, Majdanek, Mauthausen, Sachsenhausen, Ravensbrück, Neuengamme, Stutthof, Natzweiler, Dachau, and all the other camps that are said to have had extermination methods in some way or other. And Antonio has written a response to that, a revisionist response, mainly saying, well, you claim to, refute revisionists, but you have basically not addressed any of the revisionist writings that have appeared. So they basically ignored most of what we revisionists have done over the past two decades. And then he goes chapter by chapter addressing one camp after the other, Natzweiler being one of them. So that's the 14th chapter of 15 all in all. The last one is on Dachau. And as such, it is not much. It's the book as it stands right now has some 250 pages, and the Natzweiler chapter has just 20 of it, so it's not even 10%. So it's a minor issue, but it's one of the many smaller camps that are not so much in the main focus nowadays anymore. Auschwitz, Treblinka, Belzec, Sobibor were the big camps, Kerno, where the mass murder is supposed to have been committed, primarily. The other camps in the western or central parts of Germany are less in the focus. They were much more in focus at the end of the war, when the Americans and the British went in and made propaganda with what they allegedly found in the camp, like Bergen-Belsen. Nobody nowadays claims anymore that extermination has happened there. And it's not part of the book, because it's not part of mainstream historiography either, claiming anything about it. Dachau, however, has been big in American propaganda and is still standing today as a place where a gas chamber is said to have existed. And just quibbling over whether or not it was applied, was used. These things. So the book is not so much on Auschwitz and the other mass extermination camps. It's being dealt with in here too. But mainstream historiography has not focused much attention on these camps at all over the past many years, except for Van Pelt and Pressac. There has been little going on, and propaganda coming from the Auschwitz Museum. But revisionist research has been vast in these areas, and so we have reached the point where mainstream historiography rather stays away from it, because the massive revisionist research can't be ignored anymore, but they can't acknowledge that it exists either, so they'd rather stay away from it. And it's not so much the case with the smaller Western and Central German camps, where revisionist research hasn't done all that much, simply because they are the small fish. But here in that book,
but Matonio, he doesn't hardly ever let anything go by, does he?
Yeah,
I mean, he's really good about
that's right.
Having something to say about everything.
Yeah, he has published a paper on the Saxon House in Kent, for instance, a longer paper, and he has written about other smaller camps too. But not as, I mean, we're talking about Auschwitz, he has 5-6 books with a total of, in the area of 2,000, 3,000 pages only on Auschwitz. Mm-hmm. So that's hard to beat.
Yeah.
And compared to that, he has one article on Sachsenhausen, which may fill in book form and may fill 30 or 40 pages or so, not more. Yeah. So it's much less. But yeah, he knows things and he knows his business when it comes to these camps mainly too, but not quite as much as with the others.
Okay. We've got a few minutes before we go to the mid-program break, and we're going to be talking, listeners, about the Treblinka, what's been going on in Treblinka and the Caroline Coles archaeological investigation and diggings and so on going on, and how they've got mud on their face right now. Some of you may have already be aware of this Treblinka Star of David Tiles story, and we're going to be looking at that. And also in the second hour, I'm going to take phone calls, your phone calls to Garmar. So, if you want to call, the number will be 830-443-4911. So this Treblinka, Caroline Coles has really done a lot of, helpful work for revisionism, hasn't she?
Yes, she has indeed. It started a number of years ago. And the first public revelation of her getting involved in it was, I think, in early 2012, if I'm not mistaken. Now I can pull that up here. Yes, I have it here. It was published, I think, the BBC in England had a documentary briefly on it, about the first preliminary research that Caroline Sturdy Coles was doing back then. She's a young archaeologist who has been doing research.
She's young, all right. I finally saw a picture of her.
Oh, she's quite attractive, you know. Young woman. And she got herself in one of the preliminary research she did. She applied similar technology as revisionists have done before, ground penetrating radar mainly, trying to detect ground soil disturbances by using radar. And revisionists have already back then critically commented on the bits and pieces that became public. She never really published a thorough report about her research on ground penetrating data. So all we had is some media releases and some statements she made on her website. But there was not a lot to go by. But still, Thomas Kuz, back in January 2012, critically analyzed the bits and pieces that we did find out about it. And he said already back then, well, with the amount of mass graves she has, things she has found with her ground penetrating radar, would be extremely insufficient to cover the number of corpses that are said to have been buried. We're talking about 700,000 people in the second half of 1942, in the winter of 42-43, which are said to have been buried. And excavation and burning of corpses is said to have started only, depending a little on what sources you believe, it's said to have started in early 43, after which only another 100 or 200,000 people are said to have been killed. So the 700,000 were buried first, and they require quite some space. And what she has found was absolutely insufficient. And it was communicated to her, well, if you want to support the mainstream story and want to refute revisionists, then you will have to come up with, I don't remember how many anymore, but something like 10 times the grave volume that you have located so far. Not to mention the fact that what she has found are not necessarily mass graves. Because what they don't tell you, and what she either didn't know or was misrepresenting, is the fact that there have been archaeological digs before. And other events which have disturbed the soil at Trinity.
Right. They've been doing that for, you know, repeatedly for, 40, 50 years or something.
Well, she says, well, I'm the first one doing it. I mean, she may be the first one who is trying to do it with a lot of technological assistance and public support and more scrutiny than before. But the fact is that the Soviets, after occupying the area, did the first digs there, and I think the Polish investigative team did another one, and they didn't come up with what they were looking for. They didn't turn the whole area upside down, but they had witnesses that said that that's and that's where the mass graves are. They dug and they didn't find much of anything. And then they concluded, well, it's hard to establish how and where the 700,000 were buried, or they said at that time even 3 million. What's the story?
Well, you know what they did, the Soviet and the Polish archaeological expeditions there. There were several Polish ones, and they did it in different areas. And the fact that they couldn't come up with anything, that normally would just end the thing. I mean, they would say there's nothing here, you know, in a normal kind of a looking into things. But they're so committed to this story that they have about Treblinka. So they just end up saying, well, we just haven't looked in the right place yet. We will continue this at a later date.
They may be right. Maybe they didn't look in the right place. So I'm not saying you shouldn't try. Let them try.
Well, yeah, but well, and people are happy that she's trying and not finding anything. Well, we'll continue this when we get back from the break. We're going to be interrupted here in just a few seconds here and be listening to our song, the Gute Nacht song. I hope you enjoy this. If you haven't heard this on this program yet, Garmar, I hope you'll enjoy it.
Hello.
Be back.
Oh! Trittinos, las irre hunde heulen vor ihres Herrenhaus. Die Liebe liebt das Wandern, Gott hat sie so gemacht, von einem zu dem anderen, Gott hat sie so
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. And once again, that was Dietrich Fischer-Dieskau singing a song from Schubert's Winterreise. And I just got a message from Germar that he had to go and tuck in one of his daughters. So he'll be back in just a few minutes, I'm sure. And I will tell you that what we're going... This is Carolyn Jaeger, I should say, on the Heretics Hour on the 14th of April, 2014. Here he comes back again. And what's happened is that, as some of you know, the Smithsonian Institute sponsored a television documentary. I don't know, it was a couple weeks ago or so, or a week ago and only, or a little not too long ago. I did not watch it, but I've seen parts of it, the important parts. Because the whole thing, when they do their thing, it always bores me. You know, I have to watch all this garbage and so on. They featured the Caroline Coles, diggings going on there. And, they made a big thing out of this Star of David tile, what they call the Star of David tile. And immediately it was, shown to be false, but it was too late for the documentary had already been run, and then they tried to keep it kind of quiet. And here's the thing: we need to talk about. We talk about what they found, why it makes them look stupid, and will anybody will it break out and make a big difference in any way? Because and I want to tell the listeners that there was there's a very good article about this at a website called newobserveronline.com. If you haven't been there, I'd go there. I didn't look at anything else there, but it looks like there's some pretty good stuff there. New Observer Online, all one word, .com. And this one is on the Smithsonian red-faced after Treblinka Star of David tiles shown to be not Jewish at all. So
right now it's actually the top story. I don't know for how many days it's going to be the top story. They seem to have postings regularly, so maybe slipping down. But right now it's the top one. So if you just go to the website, that's where it is.
Yeah, right to the on. New Observer Online. I was hoping you were going to say it's a top story on the news or something.
no,
you see it anywhere else? Have you seen it as a story anywhere else? I mean, is this getting any?
No, I haven't searched for it because I don't have the time to do that. But I wouldn't bet that anyone is going to pick up on it. It would be worthwhile, but of course it would fuel revisionism and not orthodoxy, and therefore they're probably going to sweep it under the carpet.
Well, and you said that we have to be careful. If we talk about it too much, we'll really scare them off and nobody will cover it. Do you just mean they won't cover this documentary and what was in it? Or don't you think we need to make the point that, and get a lot of attention to it as much as we can do? Not very much, but.
Yeah. Well, I think it's already out in the open and therefore it doesn't matter anymore. The entire thing I was informed by a revisionist who is working with us together once in a while, volunteers here and there. And he picked up on it early on when he saw the public statements that Sturdy Calls did and that came with the Smithsonian documentary, that this doesn't seem to be a star. And it quickly turned out that it's just the company logo of a tile company in Poland that has been in business for more than 150 years. And on old advertisement of that company, there it is, the star, and it's actually on the backside of the tile to give it some texture so that it adheres better to the cement you use to put the tiles against the wall on the floor. And they made it look like it's something the evil Nazis did to make the Jews think they're going into a Jewish bathroom where there are Stars of David everywhere and to make them feel at home. Quite a funny story.
Well, yeah, but then the whole thing, they're so stupid in the way they go about things. I don't know what they just think that they can say anything and nobody can question them. But at one point they said that that people had, witnesses had, reported that there was a big Star of David on the entrance to the gas chamber at Treblinka so that the people wouldn't be afraid to go inside there. And yet, this is evidence of that. And yet these are just little individual tiles with this little, very small stamp on the back of a six-pointed star shape with a little circle in the center. But as you said, you know, it's proven to be the insignia of this tile company. It's on the back of the tile as their trademark, so to speak. And it wasn't going to be shown. So, there's so many ways you can make out what this Sturdy Coles and her main assistant there are saying is just so stupid, you know.
Yeah. And of course, tiles revisionists would be the first one to accept that tiles have been found, that tiles should be found. After all, what revisionists claim is that as a transit camp, Jews were unloaded at the station there, and many, if not most, or all of them, had to undergo disinfestation procedures, mm-hmm. which includes showers, which are tiled. So when the Germans tore down this area and dismantled the buildings, some leftovers were scattered about, among them some tiles, and yeah, that's what you would expect to find. We have,
but you know, these are terracotta tiles. Would you ever put terracotta tiles on a shower room? I'm just asking because I don't know.
No, they're usually stuff you put on the outside, or maybe even roof shingles. I don't know. Usually on the inside you have glazed tiles,
which don't
let water penetrate in the terracotta ones. They usually let water through. And so that's not what you normally put in a bathroom. But they seem to have two different kinds. On one of the pictures here on the New Observer Online article, I see one, a red terracotta one, and the documentary of the Smithsonian, they show one that is whitish, so they even seem to be two different kinds, which would make sense too. You have wall tiles.
People should go to this site right now if you're not familiar, if you haven't seen these things yet, because there are a lot of really good pictures here.
Mm-hmm.
They've done a great job, these people, with this story.
So that's where that goes. And we have, of course, a few documents that talks about the authorities there at the camp ordering a lot of water pipes. Now, mainstream claims, oh, that was used to pipe in poison gas. But the revisionists simply say, well, sorry, but water pipes are water pipes. And if the document doesn't say anything, that's what we assume. They are just water pipes. With some pump devices indicating that they had a well there where they've got the water and they needed some pumps to get it out and put it then into the pipes and they get it where? To the showers. And then, of course, it is Eric Hunt who has now recently released his first documentary on Treblinka, getting all these eyewitness accounts from the Spielberg Foundation, where one eyewitness after the other tells how they were transited through Treblinka and then how they stayed, some of them stayed in the camp for a number of times and underwent disinfestation and HR procedures. So there you have it. They have eyewitness confirming the story. Yeah, they were unloaded there, they transited through there, they underwent a procedure, and okay, they must have had a shower in Treblinka then, obviously. They must have had some accommodations where they could house those people for a number of days.
Mm-hmm.
And so it all falls into places, all the pieces. Now, it's interesting to see how they criticize in this article what Sturdy Calls is doing, saying, well, they found a few bone fragments, but they put them back into the soil. Mm-hmm. And oh, we're not going to bother with them. We're going to find more, which may or may not be true. But fact is, they are not, they are actually not planning on excavating whatever they find. They do drillings here and there, test drillings, like they did in the other camps in Berzek and Sobibor and where else they have done research. They find, they do some probing with drills, and whether they, sometimes they find something that looks like they may be corpses, then maybe human remains. The normal procedure would be in any other case to then start digging and trying to find the evidence. How many people, how many remains can we find? And can we determine what the cause of death is and this and that? Nothing of that is ever done in these camps. What they do is, well, we don't, what they claim is that we don't want to disturb those Jewish graves. Jewish law forbids us to disturb these graves. They are holy. We can't touch them, which is a lie, because there have been numerous cases in non-Holocaust context where Jews have unearthed Jewish graves. And I think Matanya and Kuz have documented that in their last huge two-volume work on the Reinhardt extermination camps. Mm-hmm. Where they showed a whole section, a number of cases with pictures showing that rabbis personally went with a shovel and started digging. So it's not true. It's just not true. They did that because they are afraid what they will irrefutably find supports the revisionist cause, and they can't have that. They want shreds of evidence that points in a direction that can then extrapolate it in the sense they want to have it. If they did,
well, that's right. They want a little bit, and then they can say, make a whole big, the whole big deal out of it, and nobody can deny it because that you can't get at the evidence. I remember I was did an article and on mass graves, finding the mass graves and who was in them, and at the end of it, there were two instances of Jews looking for their mass graves of Jews, mostly in Ukraine, I think, is where they were looking. And in one instance, they dug enough to find some bones, quite a bit of human bones. And then they said, well, we see that there's probably about, you know, how many hundreds of Jews, you know, buried here. And so we're not going to put this all back and cover it all up again. They didn't go very deep, you know. So they don't know even whose bones they are. But that's how they do it. And then they put up, then they get permission from the state to put up a big memorial there and memorialize that there's all these Jews buried there. It's pretty outrageous.
How do you know they're Jews?
I mean, that's what I was saying. If you don't test the bones, you don't even know they're Jewish bones. The thing is, most of those graves that have been dug up by the states involved, and some of them, a lot of good work has been done in the south, in the Balkan states. They've gone and they found, what have they found? Germans and Croats and things like that, you know. They're not Jews at all. They're the ones that were murdered by the Tito forces. They found a lot of them.
You can have the same in the East. I mean, there can be mass graves of Bolshevik victims of all sorts. Can just be mass graves of soldiers, Soviet soldiers, German soldiers. There was a war going on. People were dying by the millions. And before that, the Soviets were killing people by the thousands, hundred thousands. So who knows who these people are?
That's right. They want to insist that they're all Jews. And they don't want anybody to investigate. And that's just the same as what she's doing there. And I think, I guess if it wasn't in Treblinka, then it was in Sobibor, where they had dug up and found some things. And they did the same thing. They said, well, we're just going to put this back in here. Because they didn't find very much, you know, a little bit of this and that. And they didn't want to look any further. They didn't want anybody to find out.
Well, what they did in Treblinka, already after the Soviets and Poles had done their investigation, didn't find anything. The area where the alleged mass graves are supposed to have been, mainly the alleged extermination center of the camp, they put concrete cover on it in these huge stones. They put them in massive concrete slabs. So to go back there and try to do digging proper research in that area to find out what really was there is close to impossible. It would be a tremendous effort to get that concrete away. Because already back then, they didn't want anyone to keep digging there. And the same happened in Balzac. In Balzac, the results of the digs they did at the end of the last century, early in this century, was so embarrassing, so contradicting the mainstream story, that they have afterwards put up this concrete memorial, a huge area of concrete with stones. I don't know if you've ever seen a picture of the current Balzac memorial. They basically put a huge, like in Chernobyl, you know, it's a similar situation. It's radioactive. It's going to poison everything of the New World Order. It's going to blow up in our faces. We have to put a concrete sarcophagus around it to make sure nobody's ever going to question anything. It's going to be contained. It's not going to cause a problem. That's what we do. That's what they did in Treblinka. That's what they've done in Balzac. They haven't done it so far in Sobibor. I wouldn't be surprised to find out that they'll do it there too. So calls
At Treblinka, they've got all those jagged rocks.
Yeah.
All over that large area.
And they are embedded in concrete.
Oh.
Stay from me. Coles can't do her research there. She is doing her research in areas where, according to witnesses, not even the main area of mass murder is supposed to have been. So even if the mainstream story were true, she can't do proper research there to begin with because the concrete's in the way. And she won't get ever permission to remove it, let alone funding. And the amount of stuff she has found so far is ridiculous.
Well, it's not possible to believe. I wouldn't say that she is sincere in what she's doing, that she really believes that there's something there and she's going to find it, unless she's just found it, unless somebody put her up to it, or, you know, she's so young, she was still getting her PhD, somebody allowed her or said, why don't, you know, we're going to let you do this and it'll be good for your reputation and so on. And so she went along with it.
Yeah.
But she can't possibly believe in what she's doing.
I don't know. But the fact is she can't come to any other conclusion because it's punishable with imprisonment in Poland if she denies it. So what do we expect a researcher going? In England she could do it, right? but she has to do her work in Poland. And so can she ever say anything while she's doing anything? So right now she has, no matter what the findings are, she has to go along with the story, or else she's going to get in trouble with the law in Poland. And of course,
she probably knows it's good for her career.
Of course it is.
Yeah, that's the whole thing. So yeah, she'll keep doing it.
She was completely unknown to the world before she did it, and now she's in the limelight. My Smithsonian's making a documentary with her as the hero, and so on. Of course, I mean, same with Van Pelt. Van Pelt was a nobody until he was called by Lipstadt to her defense. Yeah, that's a career boost. And the other way,
who's what name was that you mentioned with Lipstadt?
Robert Van Pelt. The guy who wrote expert report in the Lipstadt Irving trial.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And if you go the other way, you end up like me. That's the end of your career. And you may end up being chased all over the world.
Yeah.
Well, these are the things you can choose.
It's one of the saddest stories there is in all history. I mean, it's just one of the most incredible and unbelievable messes, but we still have people moving along here. And let me remind the listeners that they can call now if anybody wants to call in, 1-830-443-4911, and has any questions. Go ahead, Guillermo.
For me, it's absolutely. I would be very interesting to see how she actually puts together her research and publishes it, because she has academic standards and she knows you can't discuss a topic without addressing major work that has been done so far. So she has to talk about the research that has been done by the Soviets and by the Poles, and she has to discuss major publications that exist on Treblinka. And there is only one by the mainstream, Yitzhak Arat, I think, on the three camps, Treblinka included. And there is then the book by Graf and Matonio, which is much more thoroughly based on documents and so forth. So she cannot possibly ignore any of this, but if she includes it, she's going to get in hot water, because the mainstream is not going to accept her addressing any of it, so she will have to ignore it all, and this is then the end of being an academic, at least for that section of her career. It's still going to further her career because that's expected of her, but she can impossibly not see what's going on, so somewhere deep down she knows she has to corrupt herself to go along with it.
I wonder if she's Jewish.
No. I don't think so.
No, I wouldn't necessarily either, but you wonder, I guess it's just, she's probably, believed the whole thing all along, and now she's finding out. Maybe she really believed she was going to find it.
She was warned by one of us that thing is going to blow up in her face, starting with the tire story. Now it has blown up in her face, and it keeps getting worse, I'm sure. Maybe she sees the light at some point. She'll look at it in some dark chamber in the basement, closing all doors, and then she may be saying some bad words about the situation she finds herself in. But it will be interesting to see how she reacts.
Well, there's been progress on the so-called Reinhardt camps quite a bit lately, and maybe there's more to come even besides this.
Sure.
People are really working on it, aren't they?
Yeah.
Well, so where's the hope lie for the future? Where are the next breakthroughs going to take place? There?
Well, Matonio and his friends are working on the Einsatzgruppen, and that's going to be a completely different chapter that has not been covered by revisionists so far at all.
Working on the what?
Einsatzgruppen.
Oh, yeah, they're back. They're back to that now. They finally, and Thomas Q, you call him Coos. I should remember that Thomas Coos is back in better health now, and right? And they're going with that one.
Yeah, well, it's. I don't see it coming for another 2 or 3 years because it's such a topic, and there's so little reliable research out there that you can actually use. So they have to build it from ground up. And if you look at the work that they have been publishing about Auschwitz and other camps, that didn't come overnight. Matonio has been started working on these things in the mid-80s, and he was loading his guns until the early mid-90s. And the first book he wrote on these things was the book on Maidenbeck, which came out in the German edition. When was that published again? It was in 98, I think. So you see from that, and that was only a byproduct of his research on Auschwitz, which came out step by step only later, because it was such a big topic. It took so much time to digest for him. And it's similar with Einsatzgruppen, a big topic, a new topic for him. He has to get his feet wet there, and it takes a while before something comes out. So I'm not betting to see it for another year or two.
Oh, yeah. Well, even that, you know, I as long as I know they're working on it, I can wait until it's done. But it kind of got stopped there for a while. But and then they were doing that other. So I guess really, they don't ever stop working. I know that. They just go from one thing to the next. Graf told me, Jürgen Graf told me that instead of the Einsatzgruppen, he had done his part. He thought he had done his, I mean, I don't know if I should be saying this, but he thought he had done his part on the Einsatzgruppen, and he'd done some of it. He was working on something else, a book that was different, more political. So I wonder how he's doing on that. I don't know. I haven't written to him and asked him, but.
Well, he hasn't gotten involved in much research lately. For a number of reasons, more personal in nature than anything else. His part to the Einsatzgruppen was more summarizing and introducing the topic.
Right.
It's not so much about doing the groundwork of research and putting it all together. So he had a relatively easy part.
Right. That's what he said that, and he said that he wasn't good. Didn't, I don't know, for whatever reason, he couldn't do that other part, and was their part.
Well, Matonio has the problem of sometimes going over the top by going in too many details and on and getting lost in all the intricacies and losing the bigger picture in the process. And Jürgen Graf is the person who likes to stick with the bigger picture and the essentials.
Mm-hmm.
And so that they're complimentary in a way. Having them both on board is a good thing, because after reading a book by Matonio, it's good to have an introduction that you can understand and a summary at the end that you can digest easily, and then you have to slog through the rest of the book if you feel a need.
Yeah, well, Matonio makes sure he footnotes and sources every little thing and all in quite detail. So you're going through all that stuff all the time. I would like to see that all put aside somewhere else and not be in the text, so I can just read the text without having that kind of, you know, visually there all the time in the way. But he has some of it separate and some of it right there in the text. At least what I've seen of his work. Well, what are you doing now? If you can say, anything about what you're doing now, Germar?
Well, I'm advising these people, trying to get them to stay on focus and helping them with getting translations organized and editing organized, and I help out here and there where I can. Right now I have three little kids, so I'm mainly a houseman and father. I have actually five kids, but one is at college. The other one just graduated from high school, or is in the process of, I should say.
Isn't it nice for you to have a big family like that?
Yeah. And then the three little ones, which go stretch from preschool to third grade. So a second batch from the second marriage. And that keeps me occupied most of the time, but I find my time in between to keep my fingers on the pie.
Well, you do, and look at how helpful the internet, the computer is for that. So, you know, all you do is just sit down and pick up on whatever you were working on. I'm not saying it isn't hectic, but everybody's happy that you're still working in all of this in some capacity. So that sounds good to call yourself an advisor. And you're such, you have this, of course, certainly Carla Matonio is not lacking in any work ethic, but you have such a prodigious ability to work. So, you're good at pushing other people and keeping people doing things, right? You know, suggesting, well, here, if you have time, spare time, you can do this.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, to some degree, it's a matter of a lack of peers that keep a critical eye on things. I sometimes get papers or books from Matonio on my desk, and then I'm going through them making critical comments. I'm not the only one, fortunately. But there are a few people who have an oversight over all that has happened and has been published and can pull the arguments together and know all the context and can spot deficiencies or incongruencies. So I'm good for that since I have been in the business for so long and know what has been published because I was a major part of it in the past that I can help out with that. And
well, what about your Holocaust handbooks collection? And is this new book now by Matonio going to be part of that? I mean,
it has been announced already for a while. If you look at the number, volume 25, if you go to the website holocausthandbooks.com and look at pick a book in the pull down menu and go to volume 25, Confronting Revisionism. That was earlier scheduled for late 2012 when Matonio shut it down and said, no, I have major revisions to make, so he didn't want it published. And now we don't know actually when it's coming out.
You said you had a new revision, but it's still not the final one, huh?
Knocking out, fingers crossed, I hope it is. You need to do, you know, got the old Italian version, the new Italian version, and make a comparison in Word by putting them on top of each other and see what has changed. And then we have 150 pages of small print because that's the way he submits it. And you have to go through every line and see what has been changed in Italian. It makes sense. Is it just a typo correction or a change in formulation that you don't really have to newly transfer into English, or does it add anything substantial that you actually have to transfer? And then I have to also compare it with the German published edition, which is right now the standard, because the English edition has been translated from the German. The original Italian was already outdated. The German has been updated compared to the Italian. Then the English was taken from the German because that was an updated version. Now he has an updated Italian version which supersedes the updated German, and so on. So we are triangling three languages and four books.
Well, you do work hard.
And there's no other slave out there who does punish himself and flagellates himself by doing that than I. So I'm stuck with it.
Yeah. Well, that's it. You know, certain people are stuck with things, so speaking of that, and before I go into that, you know, Fred Tobin had said he had mentioned possibly calling in, but I don't know if he thinks maybe. Well, if he's listening, you know, he's free to call in. If you're listening, Frederick, you can call in if you'd like to. Well, there's a phone ringing right there. I'll answer it. It's him. Hi, Frederick.
This is Charles.
Oh, it's Charles. Well, I was hoping you'd call, Charles. I'm glad you called. I was going to ask. I see what I'm hearing. I thought it was Frederick's voice. It's your radio is playing.
Yeah.
It's Germar. I was going to ask Germar about Eric Hunt, but let's hear from you first.
Well, I wanted to ask Germar if he had any kind of information about the Krieg Report, which was that famous revisionist ground penetration radar study that nobody ever got a chance to see of Treblinka.
Yeah, so I think I was the only one who ever published a preliminary result of it in my then German language journal, VFFG. I think it was in 99 or something like that. I was in close contact with Kriege. I mentioned him in passing during the first hour, I think, when I started talking about Carr. I didn't mention his name, but that was what I was referring to when I was talking about revisionist attempts of using ground-penetrating radar. I know almost as little as you do, unfortunately. I have, in the early 2000s, waited for him to finish it, and all I knew is that he got scared for good reason, that his career and life might be ruined if he publishes it. The only thing he did was put all the data he had on a CD and he sent it to a number of experts, geologists, asking them whether they agree with his conclusions or if they have anything to criticize, something to that effect. Rummaging around in my memory. And if I'm not mistaken, he didn't get any feedback, surprisingly. And that's where that ended. I never received the CD with all his data, nor would I have been able to do anything with it, because I'm not privy to the geologist's ins and outs of ground-penetrating radar data. I know there are a couple of YouTube videos out there that show him in action going with his ground-penetrating radar over the fields of Treblinka, and the commentaries there are very clear about that Kriege didn't find any evidence and that the whole thing is a hoax. And of course that would conflict with the results that Sturdy Calls has published some 2 years ago, who did find ground disturbances. Already back in 99 when I got his preliminary results and published them, I was a little bit disconcerted by them, simply because I knew that the Russians had done diggings, or I should say the Soviets right after the war, the Poles did some more. There's evidence that the area was bombarded toward the end of the war, probably by the Soviets, to make it look more dramatically by scattering the few human remains that were there. We know of wild diggings by Polish civilians that lived in the area, which has occurred in all those camps, since the rumors were that hundreds of thousands of Jews were sent there, stripped naked, and their valuables taken away. They were looking for those valuables. So a lot of ground disturbances had to be there, have to be there, but have nothing to do whatsoever with mass graves. So at least these need to be found. And Richard Kriege didn't find any of these either, which makes me think that can't be right.
Guillermo, was Jürgen Graf involved in that study? And if so, has he made any comment about it?
No, he was not. I don't know who accompanied Richard Kriege to Treblinka, but as far as I know, Jürgen was not involved in that.
Okay. I'm just curious because I got slapped down, you know, every time I brought it up over at one of the forums that I was involved with that was taken over by the Holocaust Controversies group, you know, Robert Muhlenkamp and and those people, and they just laughed in my face. They said, well, show us the Kriege report, and of course, when I started to look for it, I couldn't find it, and turns out it was never released.
That's right. The only thing you will find published is this little German language article that I have in VFFG, and that's the end of it.
Oh, yeah. Okay, well, that's all I wanted to ask you. Thanks for your input on this.
Charles, stay on for a little bit if you want to. What did you think of, were you satisfied with what we were saying about the Natzweiler? Because, you know, you were involved in learning about that with me.
I didn't do any further research on it after we discussed it. So I don't have anything to bring to the conversation.
Okay.
But I'm glad that you looked into it a little bit deeper than we did the first time around, and it looks like it's up for for more study. And like you, I don't go along with it. I don't think that they would build a gas chamber to gas 81 Germans for skulls. I think it's going too far.
Yeah.
For too little, you know what I mean? And for the same reason, I'm skeptical about the T4 gassings. Just give these people an injection. That's the way doctors would have done it. They wouldn't have built gas chambers.
Well, then there's some of those weird video clip, just small portions of.
Are you talking about the gassing?
Well, there's that, and then there's the one where they show these naked old,
Yeah, but you never know where they're being led. It's the funniest.
Yeah, led somewhere. I mean, this.
They're put on a cart. The cart takes off, and then what you get next is the picture of a shadow of a Nazi officer standing in front of a car that has its exhaust pipe hooked up to a hose, and the narrator.
Yeah.
I know who made that movie. That was Stuart Schulberg. It's from a movie called Nuremberg. It's Lesson for Today.
Yeah.
And Schulberg's daughter explained where she got that, where he got that clip. He was in Berlin, but at the end of the war.
That's the claim, but I bet it's Alfred Hitchcock who actually did it. If you look at the lighting,
it's so noir.
You pointed out the shadow of the SS officer. You need to think of where, if that is a natural shot outside without artificial lighting, then you can think of where the sun must be to cast a shadow of this officer. Then you look at how the lighting of the pictures is with the cars, and you figure out that this just doesn't fit together. What you have to have there is massive artificial lights that produce this shadow of the SS man. In other words, this is a studio setting with artificial lights. It's not some documentary of an actual gassing going on.
And no, of course not. But the pictures of those patients from wherever they were found could have been real. I mean, those people look like they were actually mental patients.
It doesn't prove anything. But
it proves nothing, of course. But it was spliced together so in such a way that you're led to believe that you're witnessing a gassing. Which is that's part and parcel of Hollywood.
Yeah, we could talk a little bit about the Hollywood thing, but Fred Tobin has called in. And he's also on the line.
Yeah. Okay.
So we can have four of us here. Hello, Frederick.
Is this a foursome?
Yes. You have to turn your sound down or your radio off or whatever.
Hang on, just wait a minute. How's this? Can you hear me now?
Yeah, we can hear you.
Sounds good.
Yeah. Sounds good.
Hello, Frederick.
Okay. Yes. Yes.
Nice to talk to you again.
It's just after lunchtime here, and I thought that comment about Craigie, I can fill you in just briefly. The important thing about Richard's work is that he's worse than Matonio, and because of that, he would have to redo some of the scannings that he did, but because he's a family man, and because he's employed, he cannot afford to do anything like that. I mean, he took so many risks even getting it done. And now the legal constraints prevent him from doing any revisionist work at all. And I understand that. But if you have a young family, Gemma, you know what it's like. And so at the moment, he hopes that in time it'll come, he'll be able to contribute, but he certainly set the benchmark for this. We had that English academic doing some work there, which came to naught. I think, isn't it embargoed for 5 years? Emma?
I heard the rumor that she can't publish anything about that, but that's a rumor. I have no confirmation of that.
It's actually on the website where I think I have this impression that, because I likened that to the Hayward thesis embargo. He'd finished his thesis in 93, and then in a five-year embargo was slapped on it. And then it was released. He gave it to me, and then all hell broke loose.
One thing is for sure, Craig is probably the main reason why Carlos is doing her research. So in that sense, it's good.
Why is he not allowed to do anything at all for whatever time? Why is he in trouble?
Because he has property. He has. He's a man of certain means. He's got a job again.
What did he do wrong that they can restrict?
Oh no, he's like Matonio. He wants to be meticulous, and there are a couple of readings of a couple of elements that he still wants to be able to work on. And of course, if he went to Poland now, he'd be arrested. He's a targeted man. Because when we came back from Iran in December 2006, he lost his job, the job he'd had for nearly 10 years with Air Services Australia. So the lobby is vicious. But this is the other reason why I wanted to let you know what's happening in Australia. The present government is reviewing the Racial Discrimination Act, especially Section 18C, that enables applicants or people to take you to court and claim that whatever you've written and said is hurting their feelings. Yes. In other words, they're reversing.
Frederick, before you go on with that, Charles had a question about Craigie. He wanted to.
Yes, Charles.
Did Craigie do his study at the site that is now covered with the stones? Where Sturdy Coles can't go?
Or Blinka?
Yes.
He did.
Yes.
So after the Craigie report, they put the stones up and cemented the thing over.
No, the cement was put up, in the 60s or 70s, if I'm not mistaken.
Oh.
It's been there for many decades. But he went there in this area with the crown penetrating radar equipment anyway. As a matter of fact, it's not one contiguous slab of concrete, but there are several slabs and they have little gaps in between. You can get a reading through concrete. It's not a good reading. And I've seen some of the footage on YouTube where he actually tries to get his readings in those gaps, which are half a foot wide or so, and use those at least. So he went there too, but of course he can't do any digging. Coles is now digging and she can't dig there for good reasons.
Right, but the concrete was there before he arrived.
It's been there for many decades.
I see.
Well, now this ground penetrating radar is fully accepted now. It seems like at one time people were saying it didn't work or was no good or something like that. I guess that was maybe Craigie's equipment they were trying to put down. But it's considered to be accurate, right?
Yeah, state of the art, yeah.
Okay.
No doubt. Well, the equipment you could probably get today is better than what Craigie had. He may not have had the top of the line equipment, and Coles may have better equipment because we are more than 10 years down the line. Technology has made advances, and she also probably has better funding and better equipment from your university than what Craigie could get.
But at least he pioneered it.
Oh, sure. Of course.
A revisionist done it.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So you're having trouble there, Frederick, in Australia with these laws, and you're all involved in this, right?
Well, what I'm exposing now, of course, is that the Racial Discrimination Act, where you have to prove your innocence and not somebody else has to prove that you're guilty, the person who is offended doesn't have to prove anything. The word is enough. In other words, they do not bring in medical certificates or psychiatric reports, things like that.
And well, it's like what they had in Canada. That supposedly
it's the same. Ours is Yeah. Now, when I was being persecuted or prosecuted, I said to the journalists who were covering this that they'll be next. First it'll be me, but they'll be next. And then a couple of years ago, Andrew Bolt, a prominent Australian of Dutch descent, did the naughty thing and criticized Aboriginals, Australian Aborigines who claim to be Aborigines, but they have blonde blue eyes and they don't look like that conventional picture we have of the original settlers in Australia. And he wrote about it and they took him to court. And the judge, Justice Mordecai Bromberg, he then used, now don't, Germa, you are being naughty. Justice Mordy Bromberg, unfortunately did the right thing in, according to British justice. He looked for a precedent case, and mine and Mrs. Olga Scully's case were used. But ours was a specific, purely Holocaust case, while Bolt's case was, in fact, a free expression issue. That's how they try to sell it. Now, the big thing is the Murdoch paper, The Australian, did not take that. I think it cost him over $1 million, while I was bankrupted and Olga was bankrupted because our costs went up to about $230,000 or something. Because when you lose a case, you pay. And so Andrew Bolt's case was not appealed because somehow they didn't want to move beyond that. Now, had they taken it right through to the High Court, this Section 18C would have been declared unconstitutional, as was the case with the Zundel case in 93 when the Canadian Supreme Court eliminated that spreading false news law, and they then introduced the human rights legislation, which we have here, the same thing, where you're guilty until proven innocent, and you can't beat them. So this is where we're at the moment, that it now looks as if the propaganda against removing Section 18C is hotting up, and you can really see now that 18C was designed specifically, and the Jewish lobby in Australia prided itself in having formulated this in the late 90s. And now we can call the Section 18C, if it gets amended, the Tobin Amendments, or the actual, if it doesn't get amended, then the Racial Discrimination Act, you can call it the Tobin Law, because it has finally come out right in the open that the law was designed to shut up the Holocaust issue or to lock it up legally.
Mm-hmm, and nothing
the
else.
Bolt case, yeah, and the Bolt case was there to deflect from it and say, oh no, this is a free speech issue. We would like Australians to be free. But what the government is trying to do is to get back to some basic British common law principles, which aligns Australia, then if it gets through, aligns Australia to the American First Amendment, where you can have free expression as long as you do not commit moral turpitude. In other words, don't physically attack property or damage property or person. And so this is at the end of, I'm just finishing a submission and I'm putting all sorts of stuff in there. And Caroline, even my review of Wagner's Judentum in Musik, because it's important, because what we have to realize is what we're going through is nothing new. It's simply individuals who want to separate themselves from Jewish influences. And Wagner did this with his music, and we're doing it because the Holocaust is that benchmark. And if people go along with it, and most people do because they don't see the significance of it, then they will see in time the claims will be made that we adopt all sorts of Jewish practices, and I oppose that.
Uh-huh. So, so you think that something good can come of all this?
at least my way out is always to say, at least we're clarifying things. I mean, today's Australian had Nick Cater in an opinion piece where, for example, Bob Carr was the foreign minister in Australia, and he's now just released his book, Diary of a Foreign Minister, where he really hops into the Israeli lobby based in Melbourne, well, it's essentially the organized Jewry in Australia, and he's saying that the then Prime Minister, Julia Gillard, was beholden to them because Bob Carr is in favor of the Palestinians getting their state. And when it was put to the vote, I think, in the United Nations that Palestine or the Palestinians should get a status on somebody, he pushed, and yet from the Jewish lobby, instructions came straight to Prime Minister Julia Gillard then, not to agree to this.
Okay, now you're just getting too drawn out, Fred. I know I've seen all these stories about this. Well, Germar, we've only got a couple minutes left. Do you have any final words for the listeners, or anything you want to say before we're
Yeah, over? let's assume to go along with Frederick's comments that Australia is liberated from any legislative has put on the country. That doesn't solve the problem for you, Frederick, or for Richard, because social persecution will still be around, and they will try again in a different way as they've done before. So, hoping that Craig will ever come out with anything, I think we probably have to bury that idea and just count on sturdy calls to publish all of her data and do the same job as we've done before in Belzec and Sobibor to make a good critique and come up with our own conclusions and to refute the claims sturdy calls is most certainly going to make with what she has found. She has already proven that she is biased and overreacting and misinterpreting what she has found, so I assume she's going to do the same with what's coming up.
Yeah, I mean, that sounds very good. I hope she doesn't wait too long. You see, I mean, we have to wait so long between these things happening, but I would like to see how this is all going to come out within the next year or so, at least.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I want to thank you very much. Thank you, Fred, for coming in and filling in some space here and answering some questions about Kriege. And thank you, Germar, for coming on the show today. I enjoyed it.
Most welcome. I enjoyed it too.
Right. Thank you.
Okay, well, Fred and Germar, good night, and listeners, good night. We'll see you again.
Good night.
Good night.
Thanks for listening, and be sure to visit Carolyn's website at carolynyeager.com.